on farms, and this is certainly something that we've been a lot more active been pursuing during the 2013-2014 financial year and having set in a strategic plan for the current year and the years going forward, focusing a lot more heavily on the rural and peri-urban areas. Just a broad overview of our strategic objectives and the targets that we achieved. The areas where we've done very well, of course, is the compliance with international regulations. Realization of human rights also 100%. The areas where we are lagging slightly behind is in the area of rights, equality, and access to information. And then also an internal target that we've set ourselves in terms of improving the efficiency and effectiveness of the mission at 71%. So now to go into a little bit more detail around these strategic objectives and the work that was accomplished and achieved over the 2013-2014 period. Commissioners have been very active in participating in a number of national and regional activities, including, as I mentioned, the International Coordination Committee, but also regional bodies, such as the African Commission on Human and People's Rights, and various other such gatherings that took place in the course of the year. What we've also decided to do is not to simply end a particular conference and then draft a report, but what we also do is follow up on the resolutions adopted at that particular conference. So we've also concluded an international human rights report, which documents the work of the commission, but also looks at government's compliance with international obligations. And again, Chairperson, we should mention that a number of government departments have yet to submit various international reports to bodies that they require to submit. We've been engaging with the Department of International Relations as well as the Department of Justice. These are ongoing concerns for us. We also had various resolutions, as I mentioned, from international engagements that we've been following up on, particularly on right to food, which is a focus thematic area for the year. Again, just to emphasize points raised earlier on, this is just a picture of our chairperson at the International Coordinating Committee meeting as chairperson, accrediting all national human rights institutions. As honorable members are aware, the United Nations accredits institutions supporting democracy, and particularly national human rights institutions, in terms of A, B, and C status. The South African Human Rights Commission has consistently achieved an A status, and the chairperson is in the picture in the progress of accrediting other NHRIs. One of the key achievements under Strategic Objective 2, which is positioning the Commission as a focal point for human rights, we launched the Water and Sanitation Report with the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee in March this year, led by our Deputy Chairperson, Craig Scavender. We finalized, as I mentioned, 93% of our cases, of the 9,217 cases that we dealt with during 2013-14, 98 stakeholder engagements. And the commissioners have divided amongst themselves specific focus areas. And in relation to those focus areas, they have set up Section 5 committees. And the Section 5 committees are the expert committees in terms of Section 5 of our old Human Rights Commission Act. The new Act refers to Section 11 committees. But these expert committees, driven by commissioners, have been exceptionally helpful in guiding the strategic direction and positioning the commission as a focal point. The committee often consists of academics, civil society organizations, community representatives, and government members are invited to these committees to participate for. Here's an example of the launch of the Water and Sanitation Report, which took place just around the corner at the St. George's Cathedral, led by our Deputy Chairperson, Craig's Governor, and also attended by Commissioners Malachi and Amelia, which was quite successful. We had both the Ministers for Human Settlements and Water attend and receive copies of the report, which we're also hoping to engage the committee on. Strategic Objective 3, which is strengthening advocacy and human rights awareness raising, we hosted our national conference on the rights of food, and every year, as you are aware, devise a thematic focus area. This year, our focus is on business and human rights. And as a result of that, we also held a roundtable on business and human rights in preparation for the response to our thematic focus area for 2014-15, as well as 19 provincial and 2 national human rights events to raise awareness about the various advocacy programs that we embark upon. One of the stakeholder engagements that has been very successful has been led by Commissioner Titus, engaging with the Commissioner of Police on developing a human rights culture within police services, and he's been a strong advocate of working alongside police commissioners together with other commissioners, as you can see, the chair and the deputy chairperson, in strengthening those relationships. In terms of strategic objective 4, we complete our economic and social rights report, which of course is tabled with Parliament. We further developed a matrix of indicators to improve monitoring and reporting. And essentially what that means is when a social committee right is set out in the Constitution, the matrix essentially expands on that particular right and sets various criteria which government is held accountable to. So it's really an expansion on the right set out in the Constitution. We also made their submissions to Parliament on draft legislation, and we note, of course, the Women Empowerment and Gender Equality Bill during the period under review. One of the other innovative approaches that we've been using to raise awareness and to deal with the matter more effectively are public hearings and hearings into specific concerns and issues. Commissioner McCarthy earlier led a hearing into learning materials. Of course, the textbooks cases in Limpopo raised a lot of concern. And we took it upon ourselves as a commission, led by Commissioner McCarthy, to expand that investigation beyond the MOPA and to look at every single province and to assess the state of learning materials in those provinces. And it was fascinating engaging with the various representatives from government departments, provincial government departments, which assisted us in thinking through how best to deal with the question of providing textbooks and other learning materials to schools across the country. In terms of strategic objective 5, advancing the right to equality and right to access to information. This area covers primarily the Promotion of Access to Information Act. Conducted 28 training sessions, 25 player community law clinics. And I do want to perhaps just emphasize the community law clinics which we've been doing in conducting in conjunction with law students at this university. We often assume that law students have a much better understanding and grasp of human rights and Bill of Rights. But we've come to realize that this is not necessarily part of legal training, and so our engagement with these law students is both to focus on access to information rights, but also to ensure that there's a new breed of human rights lawyers that develop and train through this program. It's a pilot program that we want to expand across the country to various other law schools. We completed our equality report and with respect to the Pupula legislation that's required in terms of Pupula, and we also hosted a business and prosperity conference in June 2013, and we were lucky and fortunate to have the former Minister Trevor Manuel, as well as the then Deputy Minister for Justice and Constitutional Development, Mr. Andrew Znell, present at this conference, which was led by our Deputy Chairperson. Strategic Objective 6, this is the area where we did not fare too well. It was the lowest area of performance. We managed to achieve, as I mentioned, an unqualified opinion, but we recognize, as I said earlier on, this is not an opportunity necessarily to sit back and relax and celebrate our achievements. It really is an opportunity for us to work a lot harder to maintain the unqualified audit opinion and to fix the ongoing challenges reflected in the Audit General's report. We complied with all financial and non-financial performance reporting requirements and achieved the various targets as set out in the audit action plan to improve effectiveness of internal control. Soft capacity development, of course, is also something that we have focused on and achieved under strategic objective 6. And then to give you a sense of the areas of non-performance and that's the reasons why we underperformed in certain areas, you'll notice that for the first item, participating in 15 parliamentary meetings, we were only able to participate in 14. We, as a result of a bit of poor planning, we failed to take into cognizance of the fact that it was a parliamentary year prior to the election, so there weren't going to be as many parliamentary engagements as there currently are, and so this was a poor planning on our part. Of course, we also rely on information from the Portfolio Committee to meet this objective. The Equality Review Committee meetings, unfortunately, none of those took place, and so the target was not met at all. We've had challenges with the establishment and management of the Equality Review Committee. And the chairperson, Tab, will expand on that. He sits on the committee together with various other individuals. In terms of our performance management policy, which is the PNR policy, we only managed to achieve 90% out of the 100% target. This again is an internal issue. It's about the signing of performance contracts, the management of performance in the institution, which requires some strengthening. And then the area where we also failed to achieve was around business units having to achieve 100% of their targets. Of course, they only achieved 87%. And part of the reason there is poor planning capacity constraints and various other external factors beyond our control. Moving on to some of the other areas of non-achievements, the implementation of strategic risks, annual treatment plan, One of the main challenges here has been that the audit committee has recommended that we employ a specific individual focused on risk management. They simply don't have the capacity or resources to do so, or to set up a special committee of external experts to assist with risk management. What we have tried to do is to use the services of external experts to assist us in developing the risk treatment plan, and I'm sure that this achievement will increase in the coming year. In terms of the resolution of audit findings, of course, this is what ultimately led to, or partly what led to, the qualification in the first place, but we've managed to ensure that 59% of these audit findings have been resolved by the end of the year. It's a lot higher now this year, given that we achieved the unqualified audit process. And then the Commission's Capacity Development Plan, we have put together a plan for sub-commissioners in identifying capacity issues that they would like to focus on. We had some challenges in arranging the legal training that we had set up for commissioners, but I'm pleased to advise that that training is taking place in the current financial year, so it was simply deferred to the new financial year. A quick update on legal investigations. As mentioned, we achieved 93% of cases were finalized out of the 9,217 matters that we dealt with. We looked at 4,908 complaints that we investigated and inquiries for 4,237. And of course, of those, you have 158 appeals that were lodged with the chairperson and the chief operations officer, depending on the nature of the appeal. To give you a sense of the breakdown of some of the kinds of cases that we have litigated during the 13-14 financial year, you notice that equality-related matters remain the number one complaint that we focus on as an institution. Equality, of course, focuses primarily on questions of race and racism, followed by a significant increase in cases of freedom of expression from the previous financial year. And then you'll see that our advocacy and outreach in terms of water and sanitation has resulted in additional complaints being received. So there's been a slight bump in the healthcare, food and water related complaints, up to 7%, housing at 6%, human dignity, which of course is another major area we're focusing on, at 18%. Compared last year, and I just thought I'd do a quick comparison, the equality-related matters, as I indicated earlier, remain the number one item that we are currently focused on. Human dignity, of course, is a major issue. Freedom of expression, as you can see, moved up from 3% in 2012, 2013, to 22%. A lot of those cases relate to social media and the use and abuse of social media, such as Facebook in particular, and the Commission is attempting to develop mechanisms to be in assist. Of course, with social media, it's almost impossible to track all of these issues, but we attempt to get involved as far as possible. Contempt analysis, to give an indication of the areas of concern that we have picked up, is around discrimination, and particularly, unfortunately, this seems to be happening at schools and institutions of higher learning. In the Free State, in particular, we've dealt with a number of cases of racism in schools and at universities across the country. And as I'll mention later on, the chairperson had initiated public hearings into the state of transformation in higher education, also focusing on racism. Commissioner Mirmia has initiated a project called the Know Your Constitution campaign, together with various civil society organizations, focusing at the basic education level to try and encourage learners to develop a sense of the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. So these are some of the initiatives we are undertaking to mitigate the increase in discrimination, particularly at schools and institutions of learning. Commissioner McCarthy, of course, had a very important workshop and publication on corporal punishment, which was another area of discrimination that we were deeply concerned about. So this is an area that I think requires specific and sustained intervention, and the Commission has certainly identified this as an area for work. One of the areas identified for the next financial year by Commissioner Mukanti, for instance, as together with Commissioner Mirmia, has been the question of the curriculum reform and the way in which human rights is taught and not taught in the life orientation classes at school. So this is certainly something we want to focus on a lot more. Now moving on to our financial statements, just a few highlights. That the MTF baseline increased by 14% over the 5-year period under review, which is a fairly standard amount. The actual expenditure, you'll notice, for 13-14 was slightly lower against the amount that was allocated. This was largely because towards the end of the financial year, we were given a sudden injection of money for the Maikana Commission of Inquiry, and we were unable to spend that money at the end of that financial year. So we've transferred those funds to this current financial year, which has now all been spent. So the surplus that we experienced in 13-14 has been addressed in the 14-15 financial year and were due to unusual circumstances in this case. Just a few graphics in terms of revenue grants. You'll notice that there's been a steady but slow increase in terms of the amount of money we've received over the past 5 years, just under 120 million for the 13-14 financial year. In terms of additional funding provided, as I mentioned earlier on, there was a slight bump in the amount of money we received in 13-14, specifically to deal with the Makana Commission of Inquiry. And as the honourable members are aware, we've had a significant impact in terms of the expert evidence that we've provided at the Commission of Inquiry in terms of the question of police and police brutality in that particular case. So the money was then rolled over to the 14-15 financial year and, as I mentioned, has been spent. Donor funding has decreased significantly, as you can see, from 2009-10 to the current financial year under discussion. One of the primary reasons for that is that we were reluctant to accept significant amounts of donor funding in order to maintain our independence on the one hand, but also we recognize that civil society organizations require a lot more of the donor funding than the Human Rights Commission, so we've taken a strategic decision on this front. But we continue to rely, for example, on the Foundation for Human Rights for certain private funding that we utilize from time to time. An overview of our spending trends. You'll get a sense that our personnel costs have increased by 8%, which is again a standard increase based on the cost of living adjustments that take place on an annual basis. We try to cut down on administrative and inventory costs, and you'll see a reduction of 4% and 15% respectively. And I think this speaks to a lot more effectiveness and efficiency at an administrative level within the Commission so that we can channel these funds to more substantial areas that require additional funds, such as operating costs, which you'll see has been increased significantly to 31%. And as a result of the restructuring process we had 3 years ago, as well as the deployment of additional resources, particularly to provinces, we've now seen the fruits of that difficult transition period in the 93% data that have been finalized across the country. So those efforts seem to be bearing fruit, and we clearly need to pay a lot more attention in terms of the operations of the institution. Revenue, as I mentioned, has increased. There was a percentage change of 19%, but if you look at 2009 all the way to 2013-14, the additional amount of money that arrived in 2013-14, as I mentioned, was catered to Marikana. And then in terms of expenditure, we had a 15% increase in overall expenditure. With the surplus I mentioned in 2013-14 as a result of the Marikana Commission of Inquiry, that now has been spent in the 2014-15 financial year. And then to give honourable members an overview of our budget allocation over the past 5 years, you'll notice that there's been, again, a steady increase in the baseline allocation. We project that for the 14-15 financial year, which we end at 128 million, and then, of course, 15-16, it goes up to 137 million. And I'll talk a little bit later on the forward funding around the additional resources that we are requesting. The budget allocation for 14-15 has been broken down in the following line items. Personnel costs, of course, make up a substantive amount of the money that we allocate, largely because we are a service-based institution, so the people we employ provide support to the public. And up to 8% of our resources go to personnel costs, 42% for administrative, and that includes the various costs in maintaining and running the institutional operations at the provincial level. Inventory is 25%, and capital equipment 19%, and then rental of buildings, which remains a huge chunk of our money at 39%, and operating costs at 24%. So overall, as you can see, the actual expenditure thus far is at 36% for the financial year, the current financial year. Just yesterday I looked at the financials for September, and we're now looking at over 40%, which is fairly standard for this time of the year. Moving on to audit findings and the action plan. As we've mentioned previously, we received an unqualified audit. The audit general was generally satisfied with the improvements we had made, particularly with respect to the problem areas we encountered last year, which is asset management, and then the translation of those assets into our financials. And as I indicated, the team led by the Chief Financial Officer played an important role in ensuring that we move to an unqualified audit. We have, as I also mentioned last time, established an audit review committee, which meets on a regular basis to assess the continuous improvement of the financials and the management of corporate services generally. And we want to, of course, sustain the unqualified audit outcome that we achieved in the review. In terms of the 2014-15 performance, and this is just, I mean, really brief around this area, we have 75% of the annual plan, which is the work in progress. 12% has already been fully achieved, and the remaining 30% of targets are scheduled to take place in the latter half of the year. In terms of strategic objective for one, promoting compliance with international obligations, we've already had a number of engagements there, and continuously rated as an A, rated international, national human rights institution. As a result of that, we've hosted two study tours from other HRIs who've come to South Africa to look at best practices that we use within our institution. In terms of positioning the Commission at the focal point, we've already had 91 stakeholder engagements and various public engagements through social media coverage and international publicity, as I mentioned earlier on. This is a picture of Commissioner Malachi, who has attended the UN Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disability, very important committee where he made a significant contribution to the discussion and debate, given the work that he's been doing in the field of disability rights. Advancing the realization of human rights, thus far we've been dealing with 3,711 cases, 78% of those have been finalized. And I should also mention that we have had two high court rulings in our favor as the Commission. A recent ruling on the unconstitutional detention of foreign nationals at the Lindela Repatriation Center against the Department of Home Affairs, and then also a ruling on the delivery of school learning materials against the Department of Basic Education. We have been concerned as the Commission that the departments tend to want to continuously appeal these decisions to higher courts at huge costs to the taxpayer, and we're deeply concerned that that money could be better spent implementing our recommendations and avoiding going to court as opposed to constantly challenging the decisions and the recommendations made by the Commission. So this is certainly something we want to draw your attention to as the committee, and we have been engaging, working alongside these departments to ensure that there's greater acceptance of our recommendations as opposed to challenging these imports through unnecessary costs that are being incurred there. One of the major developments that also took place during 2014-15, led by Commissioner Mokati, is the development of a report on poverty trap and social exclusion among children in South Africa. The report was done in conjunction with UNICEF and really speaks to critical issues facing young people in South Africa. The report is the basis of ongoing work that we're going to be doing at the Commission focusing on children and the impact that poverty has on excluding children from opportunities in our country. Of course, the overwhelming majority of children affected are young and black children, and this is clearly an indictment of the current systems that are in place, which entrenches poverty and continues the cycle of poverty amongst children in South Africa. Advancing the realization of human rights, we've hosted a conference on corporal punishment in schools, again led by Commissioner Mokati, and as I mentioned earlier, we've started the process of convening several national hearings. The hearings that took place in the course of the current financial year is on transformation and allegations of racism in South African universities, led by our chairperson, and the national hearing into challenges pertaining to unregulated artisanal and small-scale underground and above-ground mining activities, led by Commissioner Janet Love. A third hearing that was convened, but which was not captured because it took place after this particular period, was led by Commissioner Titus into the violence on farms, looking at allegations of farm killings and farm murders, as well as abuse of the rights of farm workers. And this has drawn significant interest and attention in the media. So these are some of the national hearings that we've been working on as an institution. I should mention that national human rights institutions have seen this practice as best practice because it costs very little money to bring stakeholders to the Commission, whether it's through subpoena or invitation, and to then publicly engage with them around difficult topical issues that we're dealing with as a South African society. So this has been a quite an effective way of engaging on these matters. And of course, we completed our 2013-14 Economic and Social Rights Report. Again, one of the areas I want to highlight specifically is our work in rural areas to Commissioner Janet Love has been running rural consultations on natural resource management across the country, and this is just one example of those discussions and workshops that have been taking place. Very powerful, low level, but very impactful engagements at the rural level, something that we want to expand upon and work on as an institution in the coming years. Lastly, under strategic objectives 5 and 6, the prior annual report was submitted, and then under effectiveness and efficiency of the Commission, we've complied with thus far 92% of all of our legislation, regulatory and policy requirements, and expenditure at 36%, as I mentioned earlier on. We've also complied with all of the quarterly performance and annual reporting requirements to Parliament, the AG, and National Treasury. The last section of my presentation focuses on forward funding needs, and again, to reiterate the very words of this committee during 2012, of course, with several different members of honourable members of Parliament, is that the committee at that point was appalled to learn that commissioners lacked the budget to travel internally to undertake investigations, meet the stakeholders, and so consequently various amounts were proposed for the 15-16 financial years. And in addition, the committee felt that additional funding should be provided as set out in the slide of 32 million, 13, 14, 16 million, 14, 15, and 16 million, 15, 16. So the total amounts that we had sought from the portfolio committee, which was approved by the portfolio committee in its formal guise, was the 21.4 million for the 15, 16 financial year. Now, unfortunately, Chairperson, I should emphasize that with the powers that this committee has, on the one hand, to look at budgets, and given that this committee has made undertakings to the Commission to provide it with additional funding, I guess it begs the question why this has unfortunately not taken place, and I would like to put the ball back in this committee's court to possibly assist us in thinking through how best we can work with you to ensure that these additional funds are in fact provided, because promises have been made previously by the former committee. And we continue to hear that the committee supports our work and that additional resources should be provided. But unfortunately, when I go to the Treasury meeting, they always ask me, well, where should the money come from? And perhaps the committee needs to be a lot more explicit about how that money should be reallocated to the Human Rights Commission. Maybe the money used currently by certain government departments to take us to court could be reallocated to us so that we could use that money a lot more effectively than wasting it going to court to fight recommendations that this institution has made to improve and enhance the work of our government. Chairman, I will conclude with that and open for a handover back to you, or back to the Chairperson if there are any additions or comments from his side.
Thank you. I forgot to render the apology of my two commissioners, Janet Lam, out of the country. As we know, he's a part-time commissioner. He's on commitment in the other capacity, the LRC. Commissioner Malachi, who is responsible for people with disabilities and elderly people, is in Grahamstown. I'm sure there are issues around the library for people with disabilities, so it would not be with us here. And finally, Cabinet referred to the Quality Review Committee not having done anything for the year. The cause of this, actually, like now, is that the Parliament has not yet appointed members to this committee, so we are not able to continue. We have raised this matter with the Department of Justice, and they said they are in the process of making this committee work. So something that is beyond our control is the commission. That's all I wanted to add. Thank you.
Thank you very much for a very good report. I want to open the floor, but before I do so, just allow me to make the following observation. That there's a debate or a reclamation of independence of Chapter 9 institutions, which we fully support. That's a constitutional imperative. We don't even need to debate the scope of that independence. It's regulated by the Constitution. But independence is also connected with the idea of accountability, because Chapter 9 institutions are independent but accountable to Parliament. And the question is, what is the content of this accountability? Because like now we sit here, there are appointments which are supposed to be made, which are not made. There are budget for shortfalls which are being raised that we have to deal with and possibly make recommendations. And there are good reports that you have generated which don't reach us. So that at the end we find ourselves in a position where we know you are working hard, you are producing reports, but there's no evidence before us. Now when you approach us for a support that is well deserved, but we are unable to motivate what we should be supporting, and we account to the people as a whole, and the people are watching us. And I guess the people don't want to see us approving things, and when they are saying, what about this, we're not able to explain. So I think there will be a need that we unpack this accountability to say, what does it mean? Because, for instance, if you have reports, you send them to the speaker, you send copies to us, maybe with an executive summary, and raise the issues and the challenges. So when we meet like this, it would be easy. But now we're sitting here, you still have to educate us. By the time we begin to understand, the meeting is over, and we're not able to take a position one way or the other. But I'm also happy that this question of evictions from farms is raised by itself. Because we had to make a law to stop evictions from farms. But the evidence before us is that these evictions take place because the landowners fear landfall and they evict people. And the other thing is that the landform is moving slow because of these market prices of farms and things like that. So it may appear that government is not delivering, whereas the landowners make it impossible for government to deliver. And I think that is a human rights issue, the right to land and its natural resources, that maybe when you deal with human rights, these are the things that you should prioritize, because failure to deal with the land question, access to land, the land and its natural resources, will actually jeopardize the democracy. So I think that maybe, you see, we are public representatives. Now we interact with the people, we know the frustration of people. You are defending the rights of people. So if there's no dynamic interaction between your committee that report to Parliament through us, it means both of us are going to do injustice to the work. I can just give you an example that there's an area called Greater Letaba and the Vembe region in Limpopo. Many communities are living in exile. People have been displaced from their land under apartheid because of the Bantustan arrangement. Now you find a chief with his or her people living under another chief, and that led to overcrowding and it led to tensions between them. In some cases, people who are displaced, they live under others, they win their land back, they don't go back to their lands, they remain on the land where they were refugees. And other people start to say, but you have your land, why do you remain here? So I thought that the internal refugees in South Africa could be an issue that is high on the agenda because it is explosive, it is going to endanger our democracy. Now there's also the question of community, what you call human rights law clinic. I raised this before to say, you know, we want people who are self-reliant, people who can liberate themselves, that we shouldn't try to do things for everything for the people. And if you look around, there are many communities that have established some advice centers and things like that. But if in this country we want all advice centers to be established by state and run, we are not going to have enough resources. So why don't we look at a situation where we support structures of the people that are on the ground other than try to create a new structure. You know, for instance, you have the Foundation for Human Rights. Instead of supporting those community-based structures, they support human chapter and institutions, which are supported by the fiscal. Is that really a desirable situation? The other issue is about racism. I think that we should be fair to the white children born in the 90s. They don't know what apartheid did or what the white government then did. They go to universities. They have not been re-educated. They practice racism. Is it really a racism that you can solve by public hearings? Isn't it something that needs education? Shouldn't we be coming with the educational program for the younger generation, both black and white? Because even the black learners, they didn't witness apartheid. So they really need to be educated. So I think we need to, to decolonize the minds of our young people and the educators. So I think that you are a very important institution that can drive such educational programs. And there's also the question of curriculum reform. You know, the world has been misled to say that human rights started in Europe, then they said equality, freedom of fraternity. People don't follow the history of the world to see that the French and American revolutions took these principles from ancient society, the great solar society in Africa. So if we can, if we accept that Africa is the cradle of humanity, we accept that Africa is the cradle of the arts, sciences, and philosophy, then we need to rewrite the curriculum as well in a way that we don't entrench white supremacy. Because this white supremacy doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with white people. The problem is that the content of the education creates a situation which makes white people superior. And we continue to teach our children the superiority of the white people, but complain about racism. Whereas this racism is a result from our inaction. So I think that we must go and rewrite the proper history of human rights, because human rights did not start in France, did not start in America. These things were there before. But I think we'll handle to these other questions because you see, the Constitution says that Chapter 9 institutions, strengthening and supporting constitutional democracy. But an unfortunate situation is a reason where there are these litigations. So there's a contest between the Chapter 9 institutions and the government department that they should be supporting. So which means that maybe the relationship is not properly defined. Because if it's properly defined, it would mean that you make your resolutions, recommendations, and engage this department, because right is right and wrong is wrong, and indicate to them that what they're doing is wrong. But if you have to go to court in order to convince them that they are wrong, it means we need an additional budget for court actions. And where are we going to get that money in a poor and developing country like ourselves? I will leave it there and also just indicate that you see, another problem that we have is if you have, I think this matter was addressed, I hope satisfactorily, before that when there is Marikana, the churches want to go there, the Chapter 9 institutions want to go there, and everybody goes there, which means all the monies are thrown there. Is there no way in which we can rationalize that when a problem arises? For instance, in your case, you have the Forum for Institutions Supporting Democracy. At least convene a quick meeting and sit and agree as to who does what and so on, so that we don't put these scarce resources in one basket and end up spending more for achieving one thing that could be achieved with the I say this, Chairperson, because I think that if we can create a dynamic relationship between our committees and ourselves, we can anticipate some of the situations, share ideas, and make sure that we take this country forward without much expense. Honorable members, I took your time. I apologize. So over to you. I'll start with the Honorable Horn, and then Advocate Mpumulwana, and then the Honorable Bonga, and then Honorable Majaki, and Honorable Stole. It's good to have you here. Okay, thank you. Honorable Maja. Over to you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. Firstly, let me add my voice in thanking the Human Rights Commission for the presentation in terms of also our duty in terms of the budget review. I think it was quite helpful. I have, however, a few questions. Firstly, in terms of the finalization rate of 93%, I would like to maybe, and that maybe touches a bit on what you also mentioned, Chair. I would like to ask an explanation of what the Human Rights Commission sees as finalization. Is it once a report has been brought out? We know that some cases go towards litigation. I also wanted to maybe link that to a practical example. I know in the Free State, for example, long before the water and sanitation report, there was a complaint lodged against a variety of municipalities regarding water issues. And the question now is, well, the findings has been made. Do you go back and check whether they are implemented, access to basic water? Or are you seeing your work as finalized once you make the finding that they are, as a matter of fact, not providing basic access to water? Secondly, Chair, I want to ask a question on the 100% compliance with international obligations. Chair, you will remember that just before we went on the contingency period, at the end of the last term, we were briefed on a number of human rights reports which we as a country, or, well, the Minister of International Relations has not yet tabled in Parliament, and as a result, it was not yet lodged with the UN. My question is just, do you see yourself as having done your job if you just oversee the completion of these reports, or do you have a further duty to ultimately see to it that the reports get to the UN where you are the A category representative of South Africa? Chairperson, then in terms of strategic objective 6 and specifically the effectiveness and the good news that there is now an unqualified report, we were also informed that when the AG briefed Parliament, it was said that specifically in relation to the lack or the absence of daily control measures, the AG already foresees that you will struggle to again obtain the unqualified audit opinion for the next year. So I want to know in reaction to that whether something has been put in place since that comment by the AG. Hopefully it's also within your knowledge. Then, Chair, lastly I want to inquire as to, and maybe that links a bit also to my first question, as to how and when does the Commission decide to litigate on a finding? We see that there are nearly 10,000 cases, and there's a good finalization rate, but there seems to be a disconnect in my mind as to litigation. So maybe if that process or that decision-making chart can maybe just explain to us. And then, sorry, I said the last question, but my last question is on the carryover or the backlogs. That must be a matter of concern, and I just want to and I know there's also in your organogram the possibility of another commissioner. We know that funding is an issue, and maybe just having listened to the Minister of Finance this afternoon, I don't think there's any good news to come your way, but how are you addressing the backlog and the possibility of appointing another commissioner? Thank you.
It's time to speak. I'll allow you to speak for two people because you represent the largest opposition party. Just on what Honorable Hall is saying, you know, Parliament has a very powerful international relations department. There is this DIRCO which report to us. And then there is yourself who do international work. And the reports that we were getting is that if you, in the international forums, you get many people representing South Africa, but who have never met before, and then you also have the provinces and municipalities. So I think it would be important that we find a way that your international work, like here we have Commissioner Mugaga, who is an expert on that international work, that we get reports of what we are doing so that when DIRCO brings reports to us or our own department, we are able to check whether we are talking as a country or as independent as it is. Thank you. Advocate Umulwana.
Yes, you nearly ate all my act. Because that's my passion. But I will try and touch few things that you did not touch. I always wonder, we have a problem in this country. We are flying very high. We like limelight and get all the good things that are known and the papers and what we do. Third question, how much is human rights organizations known by the majority of the people in the downtrodden? Can I go to any farm and say, do you know human rights? Can I go to any rural area and ask an elder, do you know about it? I don't think we do. I've never had any official of Human Rights Commission going to local radio station talking about this. What we expect. I'm not saying don't do it, but I say I don't know. But it's easy to know one can go to any village and ask that question. Thirdly, I know that when there is a big story on the papers about fishing in the farm, human rights are there, and then they would read about it in the papers. But do actually farm workers know about it? How can they connect with you directly? If there is a problem there and then. When a doctor diagnoses a patient, he just gets the history of it, puts it down and say, I think that the way to solve this problem is A, B, C, and D. And you sit down and then they have a change of oppression. When you talk about oppression, what do you mean? In this country, we had, you know very well, we had third class, second class, and third class. And that has been entrenched in the mind of everybody. Everything, from language, from culture, from anything, the third class was just told the last. Now you are trying to change that. You are trying to say people are equal, but that's the theory. The indoctrination has been there for centuries. And it's still there. For example, your cases where a person thrown into the lion's den by a European, a white guy, politically being done. Christian right. You know, in the mind of a person, because the value of an African is less than that of a black. And that is the fact of the man. It's very painful to be in lower end. You feel it everywhere. What is your program to change that? How far have you gone from the time we got in independence in 1994 till now? What is your program of action? I'm just throwing this thing to you because you are a very important organization. A lot of people rely on you to assist them. The list is super gone, question of values, question of language. Yes, there's a lot. The elderly people in the rural area, do they know that there's such a person like people like you? And if so, how can they be assisted? And do they know what steps to take? Talking about the farm laborers, oh, it's painful. Because that's the slaves. And that's a fact. That's the slaves now. And they have no home. They cannot talk badly to the boss. They can't talk about the boss because on pain of being thrown out. And they have no sense. Literally. And that we still have human rights and so on. Do you have work with local people like churches or any other churches and NGOs on the ground, you know, organizations? Are you working with these people? If so, how much impact you have and so on? So, the third thing I wanted to find out about the money of the grants you in your cash flow statement, I see you say grant or receipt. Are you only referring to what you get from the government? Do you have any donations from somewhere else? If you do, what are their caps? And what they cost for? because what you say grants, you will need to put a note to say which grant. That's all. So maybe there is an answer, but I just want to know. Thirdly, and lastly, I always say to students, if 90% of the time you're not studying, you're just moving around, are you really a student? A student, 10% student. I don't want to bring the same analogy to you. I want to find out how much money allocation is actually, what percentage of it is actually in the operations of the work. Or are you like my hometown, I'm not going to say which one, where 80% of finance goes to wages. And instead of conversation, that employs people who are service. Thank you very much.
Honorable Bonga.
Yeah, thanks, Jefferson. And thanks to the South African Human Rights Commission. Advocate Mkumbana says that you take the whole chunk of questions and continues to do the same himself. Yeah, thanks, Chief. I think my worry is about the and question about the issue of overlaps, which is a matter that also raised very sharply earlier in the day. The issue of overlaps between the Human Rights Commission and other Chapter 9 institutions, and what the Human Rights Commission think of deal with this matter, how do you think must deal with this matter. I want to say that I think we are more, when I read the report, I look at it, we are more output orientated. And it gives us problems, was in my view that we must be more outcome orientated, so that we allow the Committee of Parliament to do oversight generally on issues that relate to outcomes. And my view of the Human Rights Commission is that they are the main advocates. They are the main advocates, and they must advocate human rights in the context of the Constitution. Because the Constitution defines human rights as the fundamental rights. So, and the Constitution does not just take that from the Constitution itself. The Constitution takes that from the historical dynamic perspective of the progressive forces in dealing with these issues. So in the main, if we get to be more administrative than looking at the issues in context, because to me, and one other issue that I may raise, is the relationship between the Commission, the Human Rights Commission and the PI Act. Because when you speak about the visions in rural areas, in the main you're touching on that particular legislation. The relationship between the Human Rights Commission and what we have just raised here, which I wanted to raise sharply, the Intergovernmental Relations Act, because I have seen that you go to one meeting, not only abroad, even inside the country, go to one meeting with the representative. They are all there invited to the issue that they are speaking with one voice, but there's never been any forum that deals with these issues that they are there for. So running inside us, I think, is one of the points that, and the advantage of having an advocate in family, I think we'll be able to deal with these issues very sharply. Because there is a political perspective on these issues of human rights. And not just issues of human rights, in a sense that we just get happy that we're complying with international instruments, we are 100% on this, but there's a context. There's a context that says we need to assist South African people, particularly the rural people, to be their own liberators and to understand what are the challenges that they are facing in the context of the constitution. So I think my view here is that it's fine. Congratulate you for an unqualified report. That is positive, but I'm seeing a lot of output related issues than outcomes, because we are in the business of changing society. And you've correctly put it here that we need to make sure that, because so, where we belong ourselves, we have a vision of creating a non-racial, non-sexist, democratic, and a prosperous country. And my view is that at the center of that, Human Rights Commission must play a very quite vital role in terms of ensuring that we achieve that particular objective even quicker than we think we'll achieve. So I think that I want them to comment around that and how do they plan to sway around to look at those issues and just to concentrate mainly on administrative human rights related issues. Thanks. Yeah.
Honorable Madaki.
Thank you, Chair. Just to commend the South African Human Rights Commission on the report presented and to commend you for finally getting a qualified audit. This is good progress. To say that page 5, where you're actually indicating the effectiveness and efficiency of the commission, it's worrying to see that there's less achievement in that area. And in terms of access to information, you're saying you're not doing well, but what is of interest is how you're actually preparing to hand over the task in terms of the new act. National human rights organization responsibility. We've been talking about this to say that you are actually having a seat in the United Nations as compared to other chapters and institutions. As you were presenting, CEO, you indicated that the chairperson is in the process of actually dealing with this. Could you actually just indicate how far the process, so that actually under the extent to which the other chapter nights would be given the opportunity of also participating at United Nations level by the, because currently some of them, if they have to actually participate, they only become part of the technical team of government partners, which is actually something that contradicts the independence of the nine institutions. Also, in terms of the areas of non-achievement, you've actually indicated that you are not achieving very well when it comes to implementation of strategic risk plans. Which is quite concerning, which is something that can actually take you back to qualified reports if you're performing badly in it. What I'd like to know is as to whether you have systems in place. Somewhere you've actually indicated that you have an audit review committee. Is this the one that's actually looking into this? Is it well capacitated? That's what I would like to know, because this is an important area in terms of ensuring that you have unqualified audit reports. Also, in terms of responding to audit findings, you've indicated that you only are at 59%, which is not good when it comes to audit results for future, if you look at future. And then capacity development plan also. Capacity is very important also in terms of performance of an institution, and I'm hoping that in the future when you actually come and present before us, we'll find that these areas have actually managed to be improved substantially. You have, in terms of the auditor statements, your presentation has indicated that you spent $5 million on personnel costs, but the auditor financial statements, I think, actually indicate $72 million. Can you actually just clearly indicate why there is this huge difference and also to indicate as to how many vacant positions you've had and how much was saved from the vacant positions, and maybe to say to you the bad news is that the intention is to actually freeze all the vacant positions that we have now as part of the austerity measures that we put in place with the advice from Treasury. Who sits in the audit committee? Because from the list that we have, it's just outside people. Who from the commission is actually part of the audit committee? I'd like to get the answer to that. And just to maybe reiterate almost what Honorable Bumlan just said, you know, South Africa was an institution like the South African Rights Commission to ensure that we create a peaceful society through realization of human rights. And that approach to actually then improve the lives of our African in general. Do you ever try to look at it from that perspective in terms of assessing the impact that institutions of this nature are actually making? The one example I would actually give is, for example, for now, South Africa intends eradicating informal human settlements by 2018. We have already almost exceeded the targets in terms of delivery of houses in this area. What is important, therefore, is to know to what extent would you actually assist with the challenge of the growing informal settlements that are attributed to people that actually already received houses, but some are selling those houses and going back to informal settlements. Some are actually renting those houses. And your intervention is very important in the sense that if people are actually educated or made aware of some of the things that are wrong in terms of the whole idea of getting houses and then really getting into other arrangements, this would actually avoid the situation where almost you'd find that local government has got to get to exercise of eradicating informal settlements. And you know that then in that area it means then you have a complication because then their rights are being violated because they are the informal settlements are being eradicated, then there's going to be alternative housing for them. So which means you're going to have an ongoing problem if you don't actually from your side also intervene in that sense. When it comes to Marikana, I think in the post parliament we actually expressed concern about the South African human rights participation in Marikana on the basis of the fact that what the chairperson indicated, why would you want to participate in a matter that is before another forum? Because the understanding would be for you to allow the Marikana Commission to conclude. And then once they've concluded that you realize that there's area of intervention for you as South African Human Rights Commission, then you would actually intervene. You've indicated that you had additional funding for Marikana. I'm not aware of that. Can you actually have indicated as to whether this matter did actually come via us or you have informed us about it? Because it actually then doesn't make sense because we're not supporting your participation in Marikana, but on the other hand, you're actually indicating that you receive more funding from Marikana. In terms of the other audit opinions, there are a whole lot of opinions that I hope that you're going to be addressing when it comes to IT, no IT strategic planning base that the auditors comments, IT steering committee in active, no formal policy governing relationships with external IT service providers, no proof of supplier performance monitoring, IT disaster recovery plan not tested, backup procedures inadequately designed, and we're just hoping that you can comment about it, but these are the areas that you really need to go and work on. Thank you.
Thank you, Jen. In terms to the South African Human Rights Commission,
for the report. I just wanted to find out, is the commission a beneficiary to Donabani? And
beneficiary to
Donabani. Yes. And I just wanted to check the take of the commission on the impact of Donor funding on the independence of the commission. I would also like to check how rife is the use of consultants in the commission in the performance of your duties. And my understanding is, like other chapterized institutions, you are independent. But my understanding also tells you that you must be accountable. So I would like to check your understanding of how as a commission do you balance independence and accountability. Lastly, Chair, I just want to check, as Advocate Mkulwane says, the suffering of people in rural areas cannot be overemphasized. Recently in Fetahong, one young man was hit by a spoon when there was a blasting operation in the mine. So these are some of the things that our people from time to time find themselves subjected to. I just want to check how active is the Human Rights Commission in safeguarding the rights of rural communities who find themselves to be in contest with mining companies. Thank you very much.
Respond. Let me just say that the question that Honorable Bong raised about people being their liberators, actually led this committee to say that we need to come up with the legislation on the recognition of paralegals, community justice structures, so that the people can really solve their own problems and only go to appeal to government or the state when it's absolutely necessary. Because otherwise, we create the kinds of dependent soul syndrome to the extent that it's no longer even necessary to go to school. It's not necessary even to look for work. You just sit at home and then the government will do everything that you need. And we think that cannot be the way of building the country. So we hope that we will get your cooperation and support when we type that legislation, which we think should be introduced early next year. But another concern we have is that the universities are teaching, so they are responsible for legal education. We think you should be. They are running law clinics. You are also talking about human rights clinics. To what extent are you talking and exchanging information so that there is no duplication? The other point is that, you see, when the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was adopted in 1948, the whole of Africa was not part of that. Many institutions which developed Africa was not part. And for that reason, starting with the Banjul Charter and the International Commission of Jurists, Africa started to say, we want human rights in the African context. And flown from that, you have the African Charter on the Rights of the Child to address the realities of Africa, which are different from Western realities. You have the Banjul Charter, Human and People's Rights Charter, and that one is very informative because the West, their human rights philosophy, is based on individuals. The African philosophy is collectivist. To what extent do you, as a Human Rights Commission, when you interpret these rights and duties, bear in mind that African philosophy is collective and communal? I'll give you an example. You know, the Muslims are entitled to marry 4 wives. And it becomes one family with 5 people and children. Africans, especially kings, can marry up to 20 women. And they see that as one family despite the many people. Now, if there is a divorce, one of the 20 wives say, no, I want division of estate. How do you divide that estate? Because the estate belongs to the family and not to the man and wife or any of the wives. And when it comes to this succession, the law would say women are the inherit, which is consistent with our constitution. But the African understanding is that no individual holds property. When they say the firstborn inherit, they mean that he becomes a trustee. The property does not belong to him. He's a trustee for all family. And if a woman inherits and she gets married, does it mean the property of Bunga is controlled by the Bunga? So these are issues that we as Africans seeking African solutions to African problems, we need to engage. We can't just say the law says this, because otherwise we will delegitimize the law. And the people will look at the human rights system as a foreign thing, and that will affect the integrity of our constitution, because our constitution is anchored on the human rights culture, so we should protect that human rights culture to make sure that we mainstream African jurisprudence, we reconcile the contradictions so that we deepen the acceptance of our constitution. But these things don't belong to you as a Human Rights Commission. I think you are a very important role player, and together with others like universities, let's look for ways of engaging with these issues as we move forward. So over to you. But the rest of the comments, I really to invite you to be part of a broader discourse to save our constitution from its enemies.
Thank you, Chair and honorable members, for this invaluable contributions that you made. And one immediately feels that maybe we don't have time to meet, because the issues, each one of the issues that is raised requires a serious debate. If you pick up just one issue, you realize that how far apart are we. You know, to give you an example, when you say output and outcomes, I'm trying to think, and I'm not sure, in the context of the Human Rights Commission, where you have a constitution, you put the act, which tells you when a right is violated, the commission must provide a corrective measure. And you either write a report, in other words, you conduct an investigation, make a finding, and recommend that somebody tell us an apology, would you see that as an outcome or an output? Remember, there is a law, there is a constitution and a law which tells you exactly what to do. If, for instance, there is an eviction and you feel that this eviction is against the law, and then you go to court, you want to correct the measure, you want to make sure that what you decide must be implemented, you go to court to say, look, in our view, you cannot evict a person without providing an alternative. And then the court comes and agree with you and stops the eviction. Is that an output or an outcome? What I want to say is that some of these terminologies, if we apply it equal across, may not be applicable in some instances. So it's not a choice. In some cases, when you think we're doing the opposite of the normal understanding of an output and outcome, it may not be us, maybe whoever made the law. So there are those instances. By saying this, Chair, I'll only answer to those things that relate to policy, and my colleagues will answer to specifics. The one issue that I want to emphasize is we have requested a meeting with the committee, and thank you that you have responded to say, look, you are looking for a date to meet. Because a lot of these things are very interesting. I mean, to me, they open our eyes because you are talking to us as members of the parliament. Because as you speak to me, I also look at you and say, look, you are a member of parliament and you tell me people don't know. They are right. And I'm saying, what does a member of parliament mean? In other words, how do we complement our functions? You have a constitutional office. Can we use your office to reach out to the people? And once again, this is what I've heard the chair keeps on saying, do you talk to these other people so that you don't do the same thing? So in that meeting, Chair, will be where we'll share how best we can do certain things in the manner that we don't duplicate. For instance, when you talk about overlaps in all meetings internationally, you name them. Once again, if I go to an international level, I don't do what South Africa do at an international level. I report, for instance, to the UN. If I go to the UN or go to the AU, I'm not going to do what government is going to do. I'm going to report that my government has not submitted the report. I think I acted. I must tell you about that. Because the purpose of the independent commission is to look at how do we interact. In other words, we are not adversaries of government. We are complementary. For instance, the commission, when government goes for the UPR, universal peer review, government share with us what it's going to report in the peer review. Where we disagree, we tell government, we don't agree with you on this point. And then government goes back, they work out the report, and then we go on that interaction with us and civil society. If, for instance, in the end, we don't agree with some of the things that government are still going to report, we say so. That, no, we have dealt with our government. We don't agree with this particular point. We have shown them the record is there. That's how we interact. So we are not spying on government. In other words, we try to say from the point of view of a human rights understanding, this is how we understand it. How is this that report? Fortunately for us, in a universal peer review, we agreed to the extent that we did not even find it necessary to issue what is normally called a shadow report. Because there is a lot of interaction between us and government. And we constantly say to government, in this particular treaty you have not ratified. Why are you not doing it? Why would South Africa continue to fund, for instance, the Africa Court when South Africa has not even written that letter of declaration, simply a letter to allow the citizens of this country on their own to be We have not signed that. But we found the court. So we have questioned those things. Therefore, it is not entirely correct that when we meet at meetings, we meet because we are doing the same thing, we are not doing the same thing. It's not only in the case of South Africa, it's so in any country. National human rights institutions are not going to the Human Rights Council to do what government is doing. It's going to the Human Rights Council to share with them that what are we doing as a human rights institution. So in a meeting like that, we'll be able to clearly explain how we operate as a commission so that it is quite distinct. That's why sometimes when you talk of an overlap, I just don't understand whether do we all understand the national human rights institution in the same manner. So at that meeting we should be able to say, look, why do you talk about this principle which governs the national human rights institutions, which South Africa, by the way, is part of the signatory, which says that we must comply with the Paris Principle. And the Paris Principle explains what is meant by independence. And at that meeting, we list exactly. It's not being independent of government. No government can establish a body that it has no say. That never happens. But by specific sources, if government wants us to be independent, it will give us money to be able to employ our own staff without coming to government. And that's what we are doing. It will be able to give us the budget which we administer, nobody in there, and which is happening. In other words, independence is not, I can see that we're not talking the same. Independence does not mean that I wake up into my own thing and not, I'm within a state, I'm independent within the state, and the Paris Principle state exactly what is independent, which would be very happy at an appropriate meeting when we meet to discuss. The other issue is, how do we represent the other Chapter 9 institutions? In terms of the UN principles, the UN recognizes only one national human rights institution. Only one. And in the case of South Africa, it is the Human Rights Commission. In other countries, take Ghana for instance, the ombudsman and the human rights are in one office. In other offices, there is no gender commission. South Africa is the only country, and maybe there are others like France, for instance. It has an ombudsman for children, where they also almost caused the chaos at the Human Rights Council because the ombudsman said, no, I want to speak for myself, and I don't want to go to the human rights. But they went back to their own principles, which say you only recognize one institution at the UN. And for us, in terms of the Paris Principle, you cannot, if you are a national human rights institution, piggyback on government. You go to the UN as part of the government delegation. It's wrong in terms of the Constitution, in terms of the UN. Because you are supposed to be complimenting government, or supposed to be saying to government what is right and wrong, or what is not wrong, then you are supposed to correct it. What we have done, for South African Human Rights Commission. When we go to a conference which affects for the rights of women, we have taken a representative from the gender commission with us. And we give them the speaking rights so that they are the best placed individuals to speak. We have done so. We are on record having done so. When they draft the CEDAW report, we participated, but because of that lack of understanding, lack of leadership, where we must all understand the same way, sometimes they don't agree to let the CEDAW report or us to participate. Then they will go with government, which is not always correct. So for me, it is important for this committee to take the lead in terms of making us understand our peculiarity, the peculiarity position of South Africa, where we have other Chapter 9 institutions. And we all know why we have all those Chapter 9 institutions. must for historical reasons, there's a purpose, but then we must make sure, how do we make sure that we are all representative of that. The other thing that I really want us to know is, you know, sometimes we speak like the Human Rights Commission is a big organization. We are such a small organization. If you were to look at our mandate, with a staff that is under 200, you know, I just envy some of the things that you are saying. How do you know when a stone is so and so like this? You know, you ask yourself, how do you reach them? We're a small organization where we only manage to deal with those complaints that come to us, and a small group of people who go out on and out. If we're not reaching everywhere, that's where sometimes we use NGOs who are best placed at the grassroots level. And we are saying, sometimes you blame us for working with NGOs, but how do we reach every corner of this country if we don't have the resources with 150 staff? When in one province you have got more than 4 million people, how practical is that? So I think we really have to look at it that way. When you talk donor funding, we are not talking about donor funding from business. We are talking about where the Human Rights Council or the Commissioner of Human Rights give us money, because I think there is a refugee, like the xenophobic attack where people were killed. They gave us money, to conduct education among the people, to conduct investigation. It was a project. It was not money that they said. They said, look, can we assist you in terms of making sure that these refugees who have been displaced, they are back to their own home. Things are happening. We didn't have money. Government did not give us money. And if we only had to look at the mandate of the Human Rights Commission in the act and look at the money that gives to a Human Rights Commission, whether do we really mean that the Commission can do what we say in the Constitution? We don't want to claim that we tell you in the Constitution to do that. So I thought I needed just to spend a small time to say these things to you. Marikana, I can talk to you until we don't agree, because we are still convinced we are right in what we are doing. So, but we maybe we'll have time to deal with it. But I just wanted to deal only with these policy issues. And if you have time, we'll be able to answer the specific questions we have listed.
Now, you see, we don't really even need to agree, or you have to agree. The important thing is that for the first time, we have this engagement. You are teaching us something. We are also sharing with you our insights. Because when we engage with the people there, the people are not interested in technicalities. They will just throw stones on you if they do something they don't like. But we have a responsibility to go and explain. Now, if we don't understand ourselves what you are trying to do, then it becomes a problem. So I think I'm happy that this is a very constructive engagement, and that we agree that we really need to have a further meeting to deal with it. So be free and make an inquiry. That's very useful. If you had asked for more time, I would have given time. But I don't give people what they've not asked for. Commissioner Govinda.
Thanks, Chair. I want to support what our Chair has said. Simply to raise some of the concerns of the honourable members. I think absolutely the Commission is concerned about how do we reach people who are poor. Because that's the issue of transformation of our country. The question that you raised around the right to land and natural resources is a human rights issue. The question of how do we address the fact that there is a lack of power, and that has been deepened by poverty, inequality, and violence. And what are the causes of that violence, and how do we address the causes of the poverty and inequality? What's continuing to drive that? And so the question was of and what the ideological framing which in which we are located. And one of those I would contest is the issue of this notion of dependency of people who are poor. I think that's highly contested. It must be contested. Because actually if you look at how have we transformed as a state and who is subsidized, and I want to take one example in relation to water. If you look at rural water, 95% of rural water is used by under 2% of the population. And that under 2% of rural water, under 2% of the population using rural water in rural areas is big agribusiness. And that statistic is from the department, from government itself. So if we're actually looking at how do we transform it, we're going to have to look at why is that in 2014, whites today are wealthier than they were pre-1994. And what are the policies? And so this is not just the issue of curriculum and the issue of, and what's so important? I'm saying curriculum, etc. are important. What actually happens in the history syllabus and why we have failed as a country to actually ensure a proper history syllabus in our country that actually ensures that the children that you're talking about understand what happened during apartheid and why we have failed to do that. And yes, that can be corrected, but that has to be looked at, and the fact is the point that the advocate made about Africa being the cradle of humanity. And so the curriculum challenged white supremacy or superiority. But it's not just an ideological thing, it's founded with the economic policy choices that we are making. And we have to be able to interrogate that. What is the human rights impact of that? And so, I suppose, if it's opening up that discussion, we haven't got time right now to engage that discussion on how the Human Rights Commission is attempting to engage that. But it's one, I think, that we should have. And perhaps in an appropriate time, we should be looking at that. Because in relation to, I think almost every one of the areas that we're looking at, we're not looking at them as disparate areas because people aren't fragmented. So we are looking at them in a way that talks about the indivisibility of rights, the interdependence of rights, the interrelatedness of rights, and the reality that those who are poorest in our country bear the brunt of violations of rights and the lack of enjoyment of rights. And if you take the water and sanitation report, our finding, key finding, was that the apartheid special geography is deeply entrenched. So when the Deputy Minister Costa came to our meeting recently on the National Information Officers Forum, we asked him to address that question of how are they going to address the apartheid special geography, because the way in which you can't deal with water and sanitation unless you have decent human settlement. You can't have decent human settlement unless you deal with the apartheid spatial geography. And he started to talk about how government has failed and what the failings are and how they're grappling with it right now. So it's critical that we don't have time now to talk to all of these issues, but I think it would be really useful to discuss this because this is a contestation of rights globally and in our country. That we have the rights in our constitution, and we have them in our laws, but often we have contradictory policies. So we have the right to food or the right to health, but in terms of food, the ownership of seed is the majority of the seed in our country is owned by about 3 global corporations, one of whom is Monsanto, and that means every year farmers have to rebuy the seed. To push up the cost of food. So there's this issue that we are taking that are about human rights, but in other forums are undermined. Human rights are being undermined. And the issue of the capacity of the South African Human Rights Commission and the mandate of the Human Rights Commission is that we're supposed to support constitutional democracy. And the role of a strong parliament in overseeing government decisions is critical. The various decisions have to be interrogated for the human rights impact, not just in relation to justice and correctional services, but across the board. And the Chair has talked about, the Human Rights Commission has talked about the issue of how we wish we could be able to see, to deal with every human rights matter that's across the country, and if we have that kind of reach. But there is government at local, provincial, and national level, which has responsibility. They are essentially tasked with creating a democracy that upholds the constitutional values and upholds the human rights in our constitution. And our job, in large extent, is about monitoring that. So in terms of our resources, that's also a very useful deployment of our resources. Thanks, Chief.
Maybe it's too early to say the government has failed, because I think all of us are government. Because you
are.
Okay,
I wasn't saying government has failed.
I'm just engaging. I'm not finding you guilty of anything. You see, you are institutions to support and strengthen democracy. And government is facing challenges of delivery, sales delivery. This issue you are raising about the right to food and the link to the question of the seeds that have got to import and the access to water, those are critical issues. Now, that's where you come in as institutions supporting democracy. You are giving us that information, and we are going to oversee government. Now, there is a link now between all of us. So we begin to see our relevance, and we see our relevance and our connection with government, and that's what we want. So it's not anyone failing, it's the system that we are not operating correctly, all of us, and then which creates a situation of failure. But I think this is it's very good. You see, we say you promote human rights in other forums, they get out of mind. And that's why we're saying that we shouldn't work in silos. You know, for instance, you talk to universities, they will say, no, legal education is our thing, the curriculum is our thing. Then they will go and teach you old Roman stories and say it's a Roman Dutch jurisprudence. And now you judge indigenous African people who have never gone to school on the basis of the customs of the Romans. And actually, Romans are all dead. All we have are Italians. Now, you're judging people on the basis of a dead nation called the Roman nation. Then how do you expect people then to respect that as law? Because law is dynamic, is ever changing, it's a living system and so on. So this conversation for me, and I think I speak for my fellow parliamentarians, is very important because it's at the heart of the transformation that we see. So we have something great in common, and let's move to them.
Can I just want to add, because there are matters related to audit, you know, I would have wanted the CEO to answer, and what maybe the deputy did not finish in water and sanitation. Part of our work is to hold hearings. These hearings, we hold them in the rural areas. In other words, we go throughout the country where we allow ordinary people to come and tell us about the water situation in their area, sanitation, everything. So this report that as a result of our visit to all this, we try our best, that's why I try to show you that the life is small, but we're not folding our arms, we're not doing anything. We went to each and every province, region, and we got this information, which we are happy because even the monetary department put in the president. It was part of that process because we wanted a proper agenda. So when do you finish this bucket in our country 20 years after democracy? So what we are doing, we are now monitoring that report because now there's a record of what has happened. But following on what you have said, look, we don't know about this as a committee. That's when we must check how to share about this thing so that when the relevant department goes to a fellow departments were able to kindly check on this one. So this meeting, we are waiting for it with appointed. Commissioner must pardon me. I was only one that was good. Yeah.
From the honourable members. One question was about the report. It was what happens when the government has submitted the report, do we just leave it there, or when government doesn't submit the report, it was from honourable homes. So I just want to say that we work with government to remind government, for instance, about the scheduling of when reports are due. And when government does submit the report, we wait for the report to be discussed by the UN committee. And when the report has been discussed by the UN committee, there are recommendations that come from the UN committee. The implementation of those recommendations as a national institution we monitor. But until government submits the report, we do keep reminding government about the submission of reports. We also come to Parliament to talk about the reports that are outstanding, as was mentioned earlier. The other question related to... The other question was about where the grants come from. I think the chairperson partially answered that question, in fact, because he made an example about the grant we got from the UN. None of the all grants are project linked. They are not just money. And the other question was about the chair already asked that question, but I think it's important to, it was about output oriented, but I think it's important to place in context here that there is a formula that comes from Treasury in the compilation of these reports. So that formula is followed almost to the letter. So it's not what you get is not all the work that the Commission is doing. So it's not actually that the Commission, Honourable Bonga, it's not that the Commission is only output focused. But there's a lot more that happens in the Commission, but the report that is submitted here in Parliament is the report that is compiled in terms of the Treasury guidelines. Just so that at least that is clear. I think the question about the HRC and the Intergovernmental Act is similar to the one about different people from the same country reporting on things at international fora. The other question was about the donor funding versus independence. I think that has been answered because we don't take money from anybody that has not, we just don't take money from anywhere. So I think the chairperson answered the question about the accountability. I'm just very keen that there shouldn't be questions that members have asked that we have not responded to. I think there was a question about the money, our role advising government rather than litigating. I just want to say it up front that the case that was cited here, we were cited as a respondent and forced by the other party to go to court. So we did not go to court on our own on this matter. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I think it's the first time since our engagement with this committee that we've had this kind of engagement. And I really would like to express my appreciation for that, that we could have these kinds of questions, these kinds of incisiveness. In my view, in some areas you have become operationally involved always in your questions, which I think in terms of our independence is our business, with respect. But that is an area that we need to discuss with each other at that committee meeting. because the independence aspect is something that is valued, and we are independent of government and we are independent of parliament, but as you rightfully indicated, we are accountable to parliament. Even that needs to be unpacked. There's something about the dead Romans. There are dead English and there are dead Africans, and there are a number of dead people that influence us greatly, and we are making use of the principles that they have in, left us as a wonderful legacy from all sides. Issue of Maritana, would view, as the chairperson also indicated, is that we do have a human rights mandate in Maritana. We have to express ourselves on the freedom of expression, the right to peaceful protest. We have to express ourselves on the excessive force of police. We have to express ourselves on torture. We have to express ourselves on the right to life. These are in our mandate, and that's why we made this kind of representation to the Fallon Commission, or we will be making that soon. But we have been engaged on that process. We find that as certainly as part of our mandate. We were working on the idea at the time of establishing our own commission, which was certainly within our mandate to do so, but that we have decided against, and after our engagement with the committee to integrate our involvement with the current commission. But to argue that we do not have a say in that process, that we should not participate in that, we strongly disagree with that view. As to the point that African lives were less than a fly, not in terms of this commission. In our experience, we value all South Africa's lives. We, in terms of our constitution, uphold the dignity, particularly of African people, and all people in the country for that matter. Because there are also colored people on farms, there are also other people working on farms in very difficult positions, so it's not especially as was indicated by the advocate. In our hearing on the farm safety, what came through really clearly was also to see how many thousands of African farmers there are, how many thousands of African smallholders there are, and organizations representing them, like the African Farmers Union, like the Association of African Farmers, and their different approaches, completely different approaches to treating their workers, to engaging with the workers in a completely different way. And also to see how farm workers, taxi owners, and farmers are holding hands and joining forces to fight the scourge of crime on farms. So there is a different experience, certainly in terms of the hearing that I was hearing and still am hearing. Your point on the African interpretation of law, of the African Charter, it is certainly not in opposition to the international human rights norms. It is certainly not in opposition to the other regional instruments. The arguments raised are the exact arguments that the Asian governments raised in 1993 at the Vienna Conference on diversity of law, on the universality of human rights. The issue around how relevant is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, we were not part of it. President Mahathir in particular argued that on Malaysian side. And the same argument was put to that particular conference, where the conclusion of the UN was, yes, we really need to acknowledge cultural practices, religious experiences as well, and custom, but there is a thing such as the universality of human rights. Torture, for example, is not something where you can argue that torture me because I is in my culture, torture me because this is part of my customs. That is the language of dictators, and that is the language that we are opposing. Coming back to the chairperson's point, as he started off, when the rights are being violated, that is when the Human Rights Commission certainly has to come in. And we are not all government. Government torture at the moment, the police torture, correctional services torture, and we will come to you and to the policing portfolio committee with that evidence if need be. And we have, as a commission, have to take an independent stance in that, and we are trying to do that. Thank you, Jim.
Titus, let me reassure you and the Human Rights Commission that this committee and this parliament to be to challenge the independence of Chabotamai. It is our constitutional duty to protect that independence. So if you think that we got involved in operational things, we did so in order to address the question of resources. Because you have approached us to say you need resources. And what we are saying, if more than three institutions of government are going to address the same issue and come to us and ask for resources to duplicate work, then we will have to put questions. And the questions that we put are not because we don't believe in the independence of the institution that has approached. That is it. So we have no intentions of involving operational matters to interfere with your independence. But also we are saying you are accountable to us. And because you are accountable to us, we need to understand how you come to certain decisions, because we represent the people, so that when the people attack you for doing other things, we are able to explain that no, this is the situation, this is the law. But if independence would mean that we are not entitled to seek any understanding, then it will not only create problems for you, but also, you know, for Parliament and for the country. So I think let's look at our constitutional democracy as a living organism, and that all of us and the different institutions, we are part of these living organisms, and we must talk and support one another. And in us you'll find the best friends, because we want you to succeed. We can only measure our success through your success. So don't worry about interference in your independence. Honorable Bonga, I think so. Honorable Bonga, Honorable Majake, Honorable Sitoli.
No, thanks, Chair. I think I want to echo the sentiments that if I don't necessarily ask these questions to either prove this point or that point, but we are asking the interview and in line with us having to collectively do a brainstorming in the suit of asking all the people of your people that have voted in their majority for all of us. So the issue should not be, I think, going forward, it should not be that when a question is posed and it's like it's an attack, and the only side they must just defend. But the attitude should be, we want to assist one another, because we don't have a one size fits all a solution. We need them, they need us, and all of us who are government, I think the advocate has also said, we are all covered. So sometimes when there are all these other things set up in terms of the constitution, it's just about checks and balance, so that we are able to deal with checks and balance. But we all have one interest. We all have one interest, the interest of the society of South Africa, and to better it. And to make sure that finally we create this non-racial, non-sexist, democratic, united and prosperous country. So there will always be this engagement in pursuit of getting more and better solutions. So I think that is the context within which we must take all this engagement. So that even if the answers change, there's nothing that stops them, that when they don't have ready-made answers today, they simply say to us, we'll provide you in a written form, because we're not in a battle of fight. We are here conducting this oversight. We are just interested, we are all interested in bettering our people in society. So I think it's a context within which we must take all the deliberation, not only with them, per se, but with all other people who are coming to the to these committees to represent. Because I'm seeing a trend that you know, you're asking them as though that the answer must supersede the question and so on. I don't think we need to change that that mindset. The mindset should be we want long-lasting solutions. So as we do so, we would always ventilate, would always to say this and that, and just to check how to make sure that we arrive where we must arrive with the people of our country. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just to clarify that when I was talking about the international human rights institution, I wanted to know how we share. Not to say that what is the requirement in terms of the United Nations arrangement. Because obviously it's one country, you'll be given one seat. But that one seat, if you look at the human rights situation in South Africa across the board, if it came to you, how do you then make other chapter 9 to participate in the process? So that, you know, there's actually a comprehensive approach to it, let alone being fair to other chapter 9 institutions, so that they can also manage at that level. That gives you an opportunity to sit at United Nations level to manage to actually put forward their type of work in South Africa. But the question was not about whether we are not clear as to whether it's one seat, one human rights institution separated by the United Nations. Also, there was a question about access to information and the new act as to whether you are actually, and that has not been really responded to. And to say that, you know, sometimes we should actually understand the fact that we are running one country, all of us. So that we don't operate in silos, and whatever we do at the end of the day doesn't really help manage to take the country forward. And that's when we actually put forward the whole challenge of eradication of informal settlements in South Africa by 2018. Are we ready as a country? And then I mentioned some of the things that might become obstacles. And I'm just hoping that you can actually get an idea to whether do you really manage to get interested in this fashion for you to say that this is where the country is going, we realize there is this problem, this is our intervention as a South African Human Rights Commission. Can we get civil disobedience in South Africa? For now, you see protest in terms of the constitution. It's right, we should allow our citizens, when they are aggrieved, to really protest. But what protest finally turns out to be, it's not actually something that would actually manage to say, yes, it's fine, because then that's where you actually get the whole situation of anarchy. From your perspective, do you find this to be okay because developing into a pattern? And how do you then make your own intervention in that regard? I hope CEO will then also manage to respond to the 32 million that as compared to what is in the US, in terms of personnel costs. Comrade Sabinda, you actually indicated that 2% of rural water only 2% of rural water goes to people. Okay. 95% only of rural water only accesses 2% of the population, the rural population. Okay, let me just say, indicate what I'm concerned about. To say that, you know, that is a subject of concern. My question would be how you actually help to turn this whole thing around. What systems have you put in place as a South African Commission to engage at that level? So that, you know, the next time you find where you can say, we have actually done X, Y, Z to try and turn this whole thing around. Okay, let me finish. Yeah, it's fine. So it's about that the water usage as compared to access. Then I wanted to know as to whether you have already put systems in place, because translation is about already putting systems in place. So that we don't actually end up with a situation of just talking. And then you find that we don't manage to actually change some of the things that really needs to be changed in order for us to be in the position to take South Africans forward. And then also there was something about the African Court for Human Rights that we continue to fund it as a court, but at the same time, as a country, we haven't signed a declaration. And I'll still say, because I guess part of your mandate as to what processes have been put in place to engage, as to ensure that this situation is actually addressed. And the seats, although you mentioned the whole issue of the seat that is actually only sold by three companies for the entire world or something like that, how do we then, as South Africans, manage to come up with a system that actually alleviates that kind of a problem? In terms of the recommendations that you've put forward, you are requesting for more funding, 2.3 million for chairing the National Human Rights Institution. Was it my understanding that when the letter was brought to us, the committee, previously, there was no financial implication? Please correct me, CEO, if I'm wrong, because for now you are being requested now to put forward the 2.3 million. And can also motivate the 2.6 million that's being requested for travel, whether it's travel, internal travel, or travel that actually includes overseas travel. Thanks.
What I do, Chairperson, Commissioner Van, I will give the CEO to respond and give you the last question.
Thanks, Chairperson. Chairperson, I would be very grateful if you could facilitate that we get the report on the water. I am extremely interested in that.
It's already been brought to us, so we'll make it available.
Okay. And the other thing is, I have missed the follow-up on the Marikana, but you know, I happen to believe that in South Africa, every lab is important, and I'm worried, you know, because the media was talking about 34 people, and I know for a fact that there were more than 34 people, and some of them were police. And to me, it is very important for us as human rights and parliament to be seen to be protecting the life of our police officials. Because, you know, there's a trend in the public that police are negative. And how do we hope to deal with crime in a country which is actually a problem, when ourselves as organs of state are not talking very strongly when these officials on duty are murdered? You see, we need to be heard, to be concerned. Because right now, whether we like it or not, the morale of the police, the morale is highly low, because mostly of this Marikana debates which were mostly in the media, not talking about the death. It's not that the people were not saying that the other people should not be protected, but I would like a package protection for every South African, because I'm afraid we are really opening up a free South Africa for criminals if we are not seen to be very protective to the life of our people in uniform.
That is safe to say that you are right. We have a culture now where the right for peaceful protest has licensed people to damage property, malicious damage to property. The owners of the property want the property protected. The police have got to enforce the law, but if they are attacked and they shoot back, somebody dies. The focus is not on the aggression against the police, it's against what the police did. So maybe that's where the Human Rights Commission should assist us really to develop a program of human rights education, that human rights don't only belong to citizens. The law enforcement officers are also human beings. They enjoy the same rights, and those rights must be protected. And we must remind our people that no one wants to limit their right to protest of assembly. But damaging innocent people's property is not part of that package. So let's give the people the benefit of the doubt and say ourselves, let's educate our people, because otherwise we'll damage the very democracy that we want to promote.
Just before you, they know there's a point that I forgot about, Malikani, to say that we'll have a problem if we discuss on matters, and then you find that we'll just say we disagree. I think we need to come to the conclusion about Malikani, as to whether it's right for South African Human Rights Commission to have engaged or not. Because previously we have disagreed, and now today there's also money that has been allocated. Even if the money was not used, the process just continued, regardless of what we put forward as to what, how, why we think it wasn't appropriate. So if you leave this matter just hanging like that, Commissioner Titus, I think it doesn't really help. Because when you come to us, it's to come an account, and when we actually raise issues of concern, my concern would be if those concerns are really ignored. Or maybe if you try to go forward anyway, you do not actually indicate so in a manner that actually informs the community as such. Thank you. Could you check this in?
If I remember well, the concerns were raised about the issue as to why the commission participated. And they explained why they participated. But if there are still concerns, I think we must find space to deal with them.
You know, the committee, not this one, the former committee, where there's a problem, where it agrees specifically with my cousin, was that the commission was using LRC. LRC, Human Resource Center, as our attendees in Marikana, because one of our commissioners works his part time at the LRC. So there was a feeling of the conflict of interest. That's number one. Which they made it clear, which we complied. We removed that case from the LRC in terms of that. When it comes to the content of Marikana, there was no discussion where you said, don't do Marikana. And whether or not you can say, don't do Marikana, is a matter that can be debated. Because, for instance, if you look at the terms of reference of Marikana, you won't find the word human rights in all of those terms of reference. And we felt as a commission, there can't be a commission of inquiry where you don't have even one word called terms of reference. When in phase two, of the terms of reference, it deals specifically with socio-economic rights, which, as far as I'm told now, has not even dealt with socio-economic rights. The informal settlement that we're talking about is precisely the informal settlement in Marikana, which are part of the problem. And as a commission, it's very difficult for us to sit and leave our people there to suffer. And as we are talking even this morning, we had to rewrite to file to say, look, we can't close the commission when we have not addressed the social economy. And mind you, we received a complaint. We didn't just wake up and say, we want to go to Marika. And then we said, no, we cannot deal with your complaint. What we rather do, let us make an input into Marika. And that's what we're doing, so that the outcome of that commission must stop all other investigations like us. And during the hearing, we are the only ones who brought in the international aspect in that commission. So I just wanted to put that record straight. And we are ready to inform you more of the value, and maybe when the report comes, you will see where we come in. The problem why this matter doesn't go is because we don't give ourselves time. We deal with it in a piecemeal, and I think it must be placed on record because we have a very strong reason for doing that.
The other reason why it may not be going is when we look at Mariana, we are saying you go in, you address the shootings. The question is, are you with the police or with the community? But the way I understand it, you may be taking the view that that tragic incident arose because of the socio-economic degrading and dehumanizing socio-economic conditions. And you want to make a submission which will enable the Falun Commission not only to address the shootings and so on, but the socio-economic things. But that's why you were saying that it's important that as this committee, we get information so that we don't ask questions on things which would have been clear if we had had the information. So we don't think that the members are attacking you. They want to understand because these are matters of public interest. But we appreciate the fact that already without us soliciting, you bring us the information and that we agree we will engage. And I think on your participation, if you can give us more information and then also the submission so that the members can see for themselves what is it that you are doing without you know, interfering with your decisional independence, as someone put it, that there's decisional and operational independence, and we want to respect that. But I think now, but
I think we must make it clear, because whether we must report directly at the committee level of parliament, whatever we have done, I think I understood you when you said we must meet and share how we operate. Can give information in format of what we are doing. And we are prepared to listen. I mean, a lot of things that have been said are very good input by them. We are not against the input, but we just want to get the correct understanding of where do we stop in terms of where do we decide to divide in our own understanding of our mandate. We feel that there is human rights is involved, we must go. And then somebody says, no, what do we do in that situation?
We are not going to decide for you. We are not going to decide for you. You have the freedom to take your own decisions. But we are saying that there has to be communication, because at the end of the day, when questions arise as public representatives, the questions will come to us. We can't say we don't know. They didn't tell us. And luckily now, with Mrs. Elmarie Lewis, she has just left. She comes from the office of the Institute Supporting Democracy. Now we have that link. So when you send reports to the speaker, which is the correct channel, there's nothing wrong in you favoring us with copies of those documents. And as I suggested earlier, you could even do an executive summary so that when the matters are officially referred to us, we will even be ready to deal with the matter. So we should go that route. CEO, where are you?
Thank you, Shilokan. Just to ask for a slight indulgence, Chair, I'm going to ask my colleagues, CFO, Abita, and Ndiwe, to also respond to some of the questions. Chair, CEO, don't my term comes to an end next, the advance of my handover process to ensure that more colleagues are also able to engage with the committee. So I'm going to ask them to deal with some of the questions raised by Honorable Horn around the finalization rate of complaints, and then Peter to deal with some of the internal control audit committee related questions, and I will deal with the rest. So if I could ask them, Ndiwe.
Thank you, Chair. At a very high level, an apology to what the chairperson and members have said regarding operational decision making. the 93% that we have reported on analyzed matters. The question was, how do we achieve, or how do we achieve the 93%? We're guided in principle by ACT and the Paris principles in terms of how we resolve complaints. At one level, a certain portion of the percentage relates to matters that we provided advisory services to communities or to complainants. In this regard, we receive complaints, but find that we do not have the mandate to address them or to resolve them ourselves. And therefore, we will refer complainants to other institutions where they are likely to receive redress. At the second level, part of the 93% represents matters that the Human Rights Commission has itself resolved, and we use a number of mechanisms to resolve these complaints. We might investigate complaints and produce a report with adverse findings against the state or your different parties. We may also resolve a complaint through litigation, and therefore, a court order would be the evidence of that. A third mechanism might be that we resolve the complaint through the use of mediation as a process. So it might be any one of those processes. At a systemic level, commissioners may also use the mechanism of national hearings in order to resolve complaints. And the output of that process would be a report that sets out a set of recommendations for the states to carry forward. With regard to the question, when does the Human Rights Commission choose to litigate, the two types of matters, perhaps three, the first two we use more frequently than perhaps the third. The first is we litigate when we have attempted to resolve an equality matter through mediation and that has failed. And that will, we might take the decision to litigate the matter in the equality court. The second will be if there's some urgency, required some urgent intervention, in which case we will move an urgent application in court. The third might be if we identify that there are systemic human rights violations that impact the broad base of the population of the country, in which case we might choose to litigate at a constitutional level in order to achieve impact. The final question I'd like to address relates to the reporting of the work that we do. Members had raised the question as to whether we report on outputs or whether we report on outcomes. And I have to say that we are currently addressing the issue of outcomes quite seriously. We have a strategy that addresses the issues of outcomes-based reporting. We are for the first time this year producing a report not just on the statistics of our complaints, but also interpreting those statistics in order to draw trends and patterns that we would like to share with Parliament at a convenient time. And with regard to our advocacy, we are also developing tools to report not just on interventions that relate to the community level, but also the impacts and the outcomes for communities. So I think from my side, those are the few.
Thank you, Jefferson. I want to talk about the three issues raised. Firstly, it's about the 72 million rand on the personal rights expenditure. Even on page 85, we had to compare the budget against the expenditure. So the 72 million, honourable member, it was the original budget which was allocated, but we actually spent 65 million. So that is basically the variance, and we've had to freeze some posts. And then the variance is also as a result of some of the vacancies. Our vacancy rate was sitting at the 31st March 2014, was sitting at 60%. So the underspend is as a result of some of those vacancies. So our actual spend actually is 65 million. And also the issue of absence of daily controls, I think it might be that the report may be tabled was a little bit outdated, and it also touches to the issue that was raised about the fact that our disaster recovery has not been tested
We've tested it, we already have got a site in back of you where which is our backup to say if we've got a disaster at our Brampton office, we're able to invoke the disaster and go work there. So it might be that the report has not captured our most recent work with regards to disaster recovery and IT governance as well. And there was also an issue raised about the appointment of an aid commissioner. In the 2014-15 medium term process, we've been informed by the Department of Justice that they'll do a requirement within their budget and make a provision for us to if we can fund the appointment of the aid commissioner there.
Very much, Chair. I'll then continue the remainder of the questions in relation to how well is the SHRV known. Advocate Mbuwana has asked this question. In a recent Foundation for Human Rights study, it found that 40% of South Africans were aware of the South African Human Rights Commission. Clearly, that's a very low number, and it speaks to the challenges faced by the Commission in popularizing its work. And so we have undertaken to ensure that the next 3 years in terms of our strategic plan focuses very heavily on outreach to ensure a greater awareness of the work of the Commission. Similarly, in terms of local radio stations, we do use those stations very frequently. In our more detailed report, it shows, for example, that Commissioner Malachi participated in 10 radio interviews during his provincial visits to Chairperson in 3, etc. I won't give too much detail, but to indicate that this is certainly something that we deal with. The question of donor grants was dealt with by Commissioner McCarthy. Let me see where we are now. Oh, the question on FAIA. The Deputy Minister of Justice, who we met with a few weeks ago, indicated that the information regulator is most likely to come online in the middle of 2015, and he said to us that we needed to budget for FAIA for the 2015-2016 financial year, given that the responsibilities related to FAIA are still going to be with us for the short term, but in the long to medium term, it's going to be handed, well, most of it will be handed over to the information regulator. So that's based on the latest information from the Deputy Minister of Justice. In terms of the other question that was posed by Honourable Majaki around effectiveness and efficiency and the low performance there, we absolutely acknowledge that as a serious concern, and will definitely, as part of that process, be implementing the risk treatment plan, which you also highlighted, and the audit findings. Part of the capacitation of internal staff, and we've already held workshops with senior managers. The idea is now to cascade those risk treatment plans down to all staff members. We have a bit of a dilemma between what to centralize the function, which is being cost additional funds, or again, every single manager takes responsibility for risk. We have gone with the second option, where every manager has a risk management element, and it's overall managed by Peter as the Chief Financial Officer. Who sits on the audit committee besides external people? It's also myself, the Chief Financial Officer, Chief Operations Officer, as well as a Commissioner representative for the financially under reviews with Commissioner John Love. The new representative from the Commissioners is Commissioner Amelia, who will be joining us at our third audit committee on the 5th of November. And then perhaps, the impact that we make as an institution, I think these are some of the difficult questions that we'll pose. We do in the current financial year plan to embark a baseline survey study, which will actually assess how well communities know about their rights, about the Human Rights Commission, and what we can do to bridge that gap. And we plan to implement these surveys to assess objectively the knowledge base throughout Africa, so that we are able to develop concrete plans to address that. And then there were questions around the use of consultants. We had to use consultants during the course of the last financial year, particularly because of the qualified audit. The cost of consultants amounts to just over 700,000 rand for the 2013-2014 financial year. It is a substantial amount of money, and we are looking at reducing that now that we have in-house capacity to reduce our reliance on consultants. There was also a question from the chairperson around the engagement with, the chairperson made a very profound statement about people must be their own liberators and the support of paralegals, and this is certainly something that we support as the Commission. And so Commissioner Amelia's work on the Know Your Constitution campaign is precisely geared towards this objective, and he can possibly provide more detail at a later stage. To what extent are we engaging with universities? We have taken advice from this committee to say that we should not simply focus on historically white universities, but also engage across the country with different types of universities, which we have been doing, and we will continue to do so. The chairperson, in conclusion, also mentioned the question around the Universal Declaration, and he'll be happy to note that on the front cover of our annual report, we actually quote the African Charter of Human People's Rights, recognizing that this is a key instrument that we need to make this negotiation. Chair, I'll pause at that point. Is there any further questions or perhaps answer?
I agree with the honourable members that we shall go and put further questions. We want you also to go and rest, I guess.
I wanted to round up because there were specific questions that members have asked. The first one is around the police, Marikana and the police. We have focused areas as commissioners. Commissioner Titus deals with police. And what is happening now in terms of working hard with the police in terms of the change of mindset, already we are in that process to try also to assist police in terms of public policing and all of this thing. I'm sure a week or two back we had that joint meeting in an effort to do exactly what you want us to do. We have never taken the attitude that the protesters are always right, but we also realize that in some instances the police need some form of assistance, in the form of training. So that is currently ongoing. We can give you details about that because of time. Africa Court, we have met more times with the Department of Justice. Why we are saying it is to say, look, what do we do? We have done what we thought we could do to say, look, but why pay money? And you are not signing the declaration. We have done what we thought we can only do. On the question of how do we report to other C9? For instance, when we have our C9 meeting, we used to report to them in terms of what we're doing internationally. For instance, we had a visit by the international executive of the ICC last week. We had some of the C9 that we invited. But the challenge for me is, I think, this parliament, this committee must assist us in rebuilding OIST, because for instance, that meeting that we are in, it's not compulsory. You go to the meeting, sometimes members are not there. There needs to be something that makes our meeting something that is formal than ad hoc. So you see, we don't want to play big brother to other C9. We had thought if there is OIST with a senior person in that institution, we'll be able to convene us. The last meeting we had was when the former deputy speaker convened us. Unfortunately, it was convening us after a year or two since that had ever happened. So the challenge is, yes, we want to share with them, but we cannot lay people out and call them when they cannot come. So we need to formalize this meeting so that it becomes part of our agenda. It is budgeted for, it is known by you when we meet. I think that while we are struggling with the asthma report, that was one success that, if properly organized, it will assist in terms of which case are you taking. And for your information, there was even that our CEOs were working towards centralizing the receipt of cases, so that when I receive the case, this side when the same person goes to the other office, we already know that such and such person is doing. So if this, you can help us to formalize this meeting, I'm sure a lot of things will be settled. Informal settlement, when Commissioner Ahiebnia came, we had to give him housing. You know, we're overstretched as commissioners as we take formal, we took focus. He has taken up housing, and I know he's working on a strategic plan around that one, on informal settlement, which is part of us. We are dealing with it on an ad hoc basis, but I'm sure he would have wanted to answer for himself, but because of the time, I thought I would just mention it, and then what we have not said, we can leave it right so that you know about it. But thanks to everybody for the contribution, and
thank you for your leadership. I think you have taken us forward. We will certainly make a recommendation, because one institution that are in the office of the deputy speaker. So there is Mrs. L. Marie Lewis, who is the secretariat for that. We'll make a recommendation that, you know, convening these meetings cannot be the pleasure of anybody. Because these are important institutions, not democracy. We'll deal with that. We agree with you. But in closing, I think we nearly also have to look at the language that we use. You know, for instance, when you deal with the public protector, the language used is to take remedial action. And when we deal with you, the language is take steps to secure appropriate redress. It's the same English language. Now, we are not sure the difference between to take steps to secure appropriate redress and to take remedial action. Okay, you want to clarify? Okay.
I think in our act, for instance, where a right is violated, as a commission, the act says we can take an action, for instance, to court, correct that. It is a matter. In other words, we can litigate that when there was an eviction. We immediately saw that, you know, there are areas where you can do it by way of a report. There are areas when you can do it by way of redress, for instance, to say, look, they must stop what they are doing. They cannot demolish houses. That's what we do. But in other areas, we write a report, we make a recommendation to whoever, whether it's the minister or whatever. Where, for instance, it's a hate speech, we go to the Equality Court. It's precisely there to deal with matters of racial discrimination. Our people appear in the Equality Court. That's people there. We go there, we litigate in the Equality Court, which is very much cheap. That's what we do. When we just follow what the law says. It says we must correct it. Then correcting it is left to us. Because it says we can go to court. What we have done is, if the matter that requires the final decision, like to stop eviction, we cannot fault anybody.
You have explained it very well. You explained it very well that one option is to take it, go to court, and the law allows you. The other is to make a recommendation to the affected institution. I think what Honorable Majake was saying was that I agree with her that we should minimize going to court, but you know, with communities, disadvantaged communities, rights are being violated. I think the right way is to go to court to defend them. So I think you are on the right course. And we really want to thank you very much. And usually you see when members of parliament think that you are not adding value, they leave one by one. But you can see instead they are coming in. Honorable Mapapo is going to come in. It means that they find this very constructive. And I can assure you, we want to work with you, support you as much as you need. But we also depend on your inputs to be able to do our constituents' work. Thank you very much. I hope none of you have missed a plane. If you have just enjoyed the freedom of Cape Town. For your participation and good night.